session 32502, reel 3.
Sorry, Warwick, reel 3. Tony, so how do you transport a mortar about?
Well, the thing is, with mortars, it's very flexible. It's a flexible material. It can be man-packed, which is always fun, obviously, because it's a heavy kit. Or it can be moved by vehicles. We used to have RVs. We used to just shove it in the back of there. A lot of big trucks and stuff. Just move it around in the back of the truck, and not you have a trailer with the ammunition and stuff. By foot, if it's carried by foot, the rifle companies within the battalion will each carry greenies, so they'll transport our ammunition for us, because we'll be having like all that kit. Plus, we'll have like some ammunition as well split down within the detachments, but it's hard work after a while, you know, so they help out and stuff as well. Or, like in Afghanistan, it can be moved by air, so the thing is, it's just kit that can be just set up within 2 minutes and rounds on the ground within 5, so it's so flexible it can be moved by a vehicle or foot.
So within your detachment, do you break the mortar down and each carry a separate part?
One will carry his face plate and the C2 sight. Number two will carry like the barrel and some other stuff, like to clean the barrel and stuff, like the essentials that you need. Number three will carry the bipod and break down, like between the three, like you usually have like a number ones bag, and it'll have like all the stuff in it, like if you get a misfire and stuff and that sort of stuff. You just break that down within the three decks, within the three people in the deck. And the number three as well, I think, carries the ammunition as well. It'll carry an extra green, the other two will just carry one green. So yeah, it can be heavy, like breaking down by foot. But we don't really do that anymore in this day and age, so it's more done by vehicles and stuff now. But yeah, when people come over to the mortar team, like, when we do mortar courses and stuff, we usually do chuck in a mortar tab just to minimise themselves with how heavy it actually is, how hard work it is actually for a mortar platoon.
Yeah, and again, fitness is an important part of that, is it, to be able to do that?
Fitness. Just got to be able to tab, really, with weight. But yeah, fitness is a big thing as well. But it is within the whole battalion. Like, every job you do as a battalion, you still need to be fit. But yeah, you need to know. You need to be able to carry weight, as much as really heavy kit.
How do you target the mortar? How do you sight it?
You come in from a hide. You usually sit in a hide. I'll just give you this example from when we do our training in soldier plane. You'll be in a hide. Section commander will have a point on the map of a mortar line. He'll locate different mortar lines on the map, and then look at the. We'll locate about three. We'll look at the three, and I think which is the best one, which one gives us more cover, which one doesn't make us more prominent to the enemy and stuff like that. With mortars then, it's got a high trajectory, so to find the mortar line, myself, I'd take the mortars in a valley or something like that. We've got all that protection all the way around. You'll come in, you'll get a location of the enemy from the MFC. He'll give you like an action direction of the enemy. Prismatic compasses we use to give a bearing, just to get a bearing from the mortar line, just in the local position of the enemy and stuff. We'll set up each mortar on that bearing. They won't be in the same positions and stuff, so we'll have different arcs and stuff, but they'll be on the same bearing. You set up just like that, and then you'll wait for the MFC to send the fire machine. But yeah, usually, that's me, I'd put them in a valley. The mortars are vulnerable. As soon as that round goes off, you can hear it from miles away. Anyway. But obviously, that's what's good. We've got high trajectory, so we can come in behind the valley and stuff. If we don't really need to know what's in front of us, because the eyes on the ground for us is obviously the MFCs at the other end.
And what kind of range would you have on the mortar?
It fires up to 6K, or 5.675, so yeah, it's very, well, it's a good fire rate of fire, like a good distance to fire, 6K, so.
And you said obviously number two, loads of mortar and it fires. How's that done?
He'll usually just pull the pin. Obviously, when he pulls his pin, it's primed, but it's not armed. It's not a grenade, it's not going to go off. You know, you can pull the pin and you just place it down on the ground again if you're not going to fire it. As he places the round down the barrel, at the bottom of the barrel then there's a firing pin, and that was struck like a cushion cap on the round. And around the round then we have like these things we call augmented cartridges. And this has just got like TNT, like a small dose of TNT inside him. This is what gives it the oomph just to go and stuff. It usually comes with six of them. The reason we have these then, when we fire the mortars, the distance is usually created from these. So say, like if it's charged two, you just attach your two on and it will go like within 2k in that sort of area. Obviously, it goes up to charge five, which will fire up to 5k. So yeah, it's a percussion cap. They something inside the mortar, like primary cartridge and that. It's got little flash holes that will then burn the augmented cartridge and that will then send the round off.
And is there a sort of technique for dropping the bomb in there?
Yeah, I have to place it in both hands on it, round the mortar round, just guide it in. Guide it into the barrel, you can't just like chuck it down, guide it in, and when they put it down, they need to follow it all the way down. So the thing is, when it goes off, there's about a 10 metre like flash, and it's not bad, but that's the drills we teach, the basic drills, but there's a few guys, like the Cindy eyebrows and hairs before, because of that. But you can't really see it during the day, it's at night when you're firing your loom and night shoots, you'll see this massive ball of flame. So yeah, that's what we say, follow it down. And then as soon as it's off, go up and chuck another one down and stuff like that.
And is there a procedure if you have a misfire?
Yeah, we've got these things we call the tool instructed misfire rounds. The immediate reaction then, if the round doesn't go off, so the number one will pull down on the buffer carriage three times, just to see if he can send the round off. Obviously if it does, which I've never seen that, we then just report that a number more round off line and stuff. If not, then you usually have to wait 2 minutes, or depending on how hot the bow is. We don't really say, like, if you've got a misfire, the bow is, like, really hot, you need to, like, wait. Don't try and get out, it might knock off, you know. So, if you wait 2 minutes, then there's a drill that they all go through, which is taught before they even become mortarmen, to get that round out. Identifying the problem, and then we can just carry on again and stuff. But, yeah. A lot of people flap, like a lot of people panic like when they get a misfire, like if this is their first misfire and stuff. So I think the round's going to go off, they're pulling it out, because it's like the tool we use, like comes with straps, and they have to use the straps to pull them. There's all like drills they get taught to do with that. I mean, we've got that, and we use like a tip-up drill as well, where we'd loosen off the bipod and release the barrel from the base plate, and then we'll just tip it up, and then a number two or number three will go around and we'll just catch it as a number, like the other two, just lift the barrel up. But yeah, get a lot of people like flapping about that, but yeah, it's not going to go off.
And when you're setting up the mortar, do you ever have to sort of put something under the base plate to keep it loaded to stop it sinking?
Yeah,
we
usually dig out ground. If we're doing mortar firing in the UK, like in Salisbury Plain, especially in Salisbury Plain, we dig it out of the ground, it's quite soft anyway. And then we'll place a few sandbags and we'll put the mortar on there and we'll bed it in with two rounds to make a stable platform. I can remember out on the Falkland Islands, we'd have like the ration bag base plate, because the ground out there is really hard and chalky, and like the mortar barrel, like when it fires, it's like 80 tonnes square pressure going through that base plate. If that's on hard surface, that's going to crack. I mean, it cracked in Afghan. Base plate split in half, and I've never seen that before. But yeah, we have like a ration bag system which we've used out in Afghan and what we used out in where we've done live firing in Falklands before as well. But Salisbury Plain, like where it's soft ground, we'll just not even full sandbags, just empty ones, just lay them down, just make a little stable platform, bed it in, and yeah, we're good to go.
So you were saying obviously you were doing your, was it your full observation? Was that what you were doing in 2003 for the mortars? What was the career?
Yeah, I was just learning all about the weapon system, the jobs of MFCs and stuff, and just basically learned you as well how to give a mortar lesson and stuff like that. So you learn how to do mortar lessons like in the first few weeks, and then you go out on the ranges and you do like an MFC task and stuff, and obviously you constantly watch them marked and graded on stuff like that.
So, what was the next stage for you? We're in 2003. You'd done those courses. What were you up to then?
2004, 2005 sort of time. I went on a posting away, recruiting for 2 years. just in Colchester, just recruited for a couple of years.
So how does that work? Are you just in the recruitment office?
Just something I asked for, really. And got it. Just wanted to change up a bit. I had a family and stuff. Iraq was coming up, I didn't really fancy going to Iraq and stuff. So I thought, no, I just want to change. I don't want to do something that's recruitment stuff, see how that goes and see how we get on with that and go around schools and try and just do something different, you know. I just wanted to break up my career a little bit. I mean, I was gutted I missed the rock, but yeah, I've done that for 2 years and then I come back.
Was that a useful thing though with the recruiting? Does it get you know, does it get you, does it focus you on how the army is and what you want to do in careers and that sort of stuff?
It does, and also gives you an insight onto City Street on how people feel of us on City Street. Like speaking to people from schools and stuff and that, like people that are interested in joining up and stuff, and just doing like days out with like interest periods, like assault courses and stuff like that. And then you can do courses and stuff while you're down there and stuff, you know. Like I said, I didn't do great at school, so I was doing like my MVQs again and stuff like that. You just got a lot of time to yourself, and you're out there giving the battalion a good name and stuff as well. And grabbing more fresh meat for the grinder, you know? New lads that are interested in the army and stuff.
Does it surprise you sometimes that when you're talking to civilians about their kind of level of knowledge of what's going on in the army and what the army does?
There's a lot of knowledge out there, I don't think. Changed a bit now, but back then, not a lot of people would. Some people would even know who our regiment was anyway. So,
they wouldn't know that it was a local regiment to go to the Colchester?
I have no idea. They often know about paras and marines. So yeah, people down there go, are you a para? Are you a marine? No. I'm Royal Army. Oh, who are they? And it's just explained to them. Oh, really? Yeah. But yeah, the knowledge of people on Civvy Street, I mean, 20 to like 30 years, like that sort of age, didn't have a clue. You know, obviously you've got the old times and stuff, and the veterans and stuff, obviously know loads, don't they? But yeah, if I was surprised, there weren't a lot of people that knew quite a lot about the army.
Did you, when you were doing that, did you get to meet veterans in your kind of day to day bit?
I used to meet them quite a lot, I meet them all the time. Like, used to go to Cambridge a lot with D Company, Cambridge Company. Every like year, we'll go down to Cambridge and there'd be a march and stuff, and then talk to veterans and stuff at the end and stuff like that. But yeah, meeting all the time, not meeting the army and stuff. It's good to meet up with them and stuff as well. I mean, we've got the utmost respect for all of them who are out there and done that stuff up in World War One and Two. But it's good to hear their stories as well, and some of them, like the old times, are crazy people. The stuff they've done and how they're still alive and stuff is beyond me. Like the stuff they've done out there.
Okay, so you came back from recruiting, was that 2005, yeah?
Yeah.
What was the next stage then?
No, that's 2006 sort of time.
Okay.
Come back then. Just quiet, really. Just back into battalion life again. Just back into more platoon, like the first and stuff, and just back doing fucking fitness tests and stuff like that. So when you're away in recruiting, come back, like, it's always a challenge, like, there's always like new faces and stuff, like new people joined up with you, because you wait for 2 years, it's just new faces and stuff like that. But yeah, got back into some things pretty quick. And then, we've got the news that Afghan is coming up.
So did you have to do any preparation for going out to Afghan?
Yeah, we've done like a TESEX again, back down soldier planning for 3 weeks and stuff, like with all the laser quest kit or whatever they call it, stuff down there. No, it was back doing like lessons. Like, you had like Israelis and people come back down and stuff just to do that sort of stuff again. You had classes where you're learning the language and just stuff like that, and just loads of like briefings and stuff. Like from the CO and other people coming in to do briefings and stuff like that. Just give us some insight of what it is like out there. I mean, obviously we knew all the stories of the free power out there at the minute.
Did you get anybody in from the Paris to talk to you about what had been going on?
Yeah, when we were down soldier playing on the mortar live firing exercise, a few guys from Free Power come and chat to us just to give us an insight. But from mortars, these guys, for the Free Power guys that are in Sammy, So, yeah, that was a bit of a shock from those propellers.
So you were aware then, were you, that the situation was a bit different from when you'd been to Afghan before?
Yeah, a lot different. Actually, this was like a two-way range now, you know? Real bullets and stuff like that, so yeah, it was... Everyone was buzzing from it, though. I mean, all the guys were like looking forward to it and stuff, but yeah, we knew it was just going to be like a hard test for the battalion, like, for all the guys in it and stuff like that as well.
Had the rules of engagement changed?
It did out there. It's most of the time we were out there, like, you worked up off a card called 4-9 Alpha, card like that. Rules of engagements were like, if you feel like there's any threat of anything, shoot. Always give a warning shot and stuff. I mean, this is crazy, I mean, because not in the army, like, up to that time, never shot at a person before, right? And it was happening all the time, so rules of engagement.
And different from the rules of engagement you had in Northern Ireland, I think.
Yeah, so I found you working off a white car, yeah, working off your own instincts.
Is that quite, I was going to say, quite liberating, really, that you can actually use your own instincts to do open fire rather than having to be restricted by what you can and can't do?
You work, if you know there's a threat or something and you feel like it's going to be a threat, then, yeah, people are just giving warning shots first. Still going after the warning shot, and it usually, well, most, like, 8 times out of 10 always turn into a massive firefight. But yeah, a lot different out there.
How did you get out? Oh, did you go to Kenya at all?
Yeah.
Was that, what was that for? Was that acclimatisation or was it live firing?
Acclimatisation, yeah. Chucking off starts and live firing exercises. So, yeah, it's the heat out there, I mean, it's even hotter than fucking Afghan.
How long did you go out for to prepare yourself?
I was out there for a month, almost. I went out there, done like some mortar and live firing exercises and stuff, and then there was like loads of final exercises at the end and stuff with all like mortars and everything chucked in. But yeah, I remember it being just a bit so fucking not out there and stuff, but yeah, acclimatisation and then like everything at the end. Like exercise and stuff.
And was it back to the UK before you deployed out
to Afghanistan? Yeah, I come back to the UK. It was one of the last to go out to Afghanistan.
Why was that?
And I just fell into that package a couple of weeks in when I was out there.
How'd you get out there?
Just flew by Bryce Norton straight to Kandahar, spent the night in Kandahar and then got on a Herc to Camp Bastion, and then there you do your training packages.
Is that an acclimatisation period as well as training packages?
No, it's more like garden ranges, your own weapons and stuff, having briefings and stuff like that, just letting you know and stuff like that. Letting you know like, the situation out there, what's going on. And what's happened since like the battalion's been out there and stuff like that.
And what was the situation as you were briefed at that time?
Generally quiet at the time, when I got out there. There's a few stories, like a few some contacts and stuff, like there were some firefights and that, so we knew it was all for real and stuff, but yeah, it was pretty quiet.
So what was the first, you know, detachment, a deployment that you went on from Camp Bastion?
Probably a month later. It took a while before we even got the down. When you had guys out there, I was just out and I was sitting in the tires, sitting in the camp, and obviously, what people saying, be careful what you wish for, because
you might get it.
It'll come a lot more around. There's a time actually I was sitting in, like, the people ready to go out on or not with Wrecking Platoon. We were going to go out and I can't remember actually what the op was going to be about, but we were going to go out. It'd be a long drive down the A1 highway, whatever they call it out there. Escort, I think, as well. It was just going to be a massive escort for like logistic corps and stuff, and had to do something. It's going to be a 2-day turnaround or something, but that never happened. They got pushed back. And then the first stop I actually went on was what's that first stop?
It's Silicon.
Silicon. Yeah, Silicon was the first one I went on.
What did that, what was that, well, what
was
were you doing
basically? It was actually a big company, it's an NFC. There was me, obviously, when you know an NFC party, there's two of you. There's an Alpha, which is an advanced one, and then obviously there's a Bravo, so like in this section, it's like a section client on it, obviously, it's just something bad. should work together. He was out on ground, I was up in the high ground. It was alright actually, it went too bad. Quiet at first, and then all of a sudden all hell broke loose.
What happened there? How did that?
Just RPGs flying out from everywhere, and then just one massive firefight, and it went on for a few, 3 hours or so.
And were you, what?
I was up on a high ground, looking out like enemy positions and stuff, and getting fire missions and stuff. The thing out there, I mean, it's trees and everything, you know, it's nothing like freaking desert or nothing. It's compounds, it's trees, you can't see everything around. I mean, all hell's breaking loose, you're trying to find out where friendly forces are and stuff, and how far away they are, if you want to drop around near there and stuff like that, so it's all hell. So at that point, I was just like talking my Alpha MSC on to where the enemy was and stuff like that, and then we were just sorting out a fire mission just back and forth like that.
How were you getting your information to, as to where they were? Were you trying to, because obviously, was it difficult for you to spot in there?
Yeah, I could see a lot. I was up there as well, I had like an ATEP commander which calls in the air and stuff as well. I mean, we have quite a few eyes on the ground, we have like an FSG support group as well with you, like all split up around the high ground and stuff, so there's a lot of eyes on into that, like objective and stuff, but yeah. Obviously, put your binos and stuff, you just keep your watchful eye on the ground and stuff, so.
You're trying to identify anywhere that you've been fired up?
Yeah, right? Anything like. You never actually see anyone, I can't remember seeing anyone out there, and just like the flashes, or someone saying that there's someone there, but the hardest spot because they've been hiding and shooting them.
And are they tending to just take a shot at you and then disappear?
No, most of them out there are just taking us on. Obviously the tactics from the males changed out there now, because they're shooting and scooting quite a lot, but yeah. Some heavy firefights and stuff, and then there's always like the odd RPGs to get fired at the guys and stuff. And then that bus was, it's just whooshing everywhere. I don't know. I can't really explain it. How frightening it is.
And when you're in that kind of a situation, have you got no kind of idea really how many there are or what you're facing really, or where the main threats are coming from?
Do like obviously before you start the op, you get given obviously the briefing and stuff. All the commanders and all the briefing. They'll talk about the general number and threat and stuff on the objectives. Obviously, you would have a recce watching that position and stuff, or someone else like watching the ground and stuff, or the pattern of glass and stuff like that. I don't know, I couldn't really tell. Just you get given a number on your like your briefings and stuff, and you just go by that. And obviously, you've got interpreters with you and stuff, and they're all constantly on the icon listening to the Taliban chat and stuff like that.
What's the Taliban's kind of radio discipline like?
I've never heard of it. Yeah, they'd let you know, like, but your interpreters are saying, yeah, one of just the distance, and then they're going to open fire in a minute, or they're going to set up an ambush and stuff like that. And it's 50-50, sometimes it happened, sometimes it didn't. But, yeah.
What impressions did you get of their kind of fighting qualities?
Not bad at all, pretty good. Yeah, alright. I mean, obviously not as advanced as the British Army, but they've still got like heavy machine guns and they've got like their own mortars and stuff like that, and obviously like their RPGs and stuff.
When you're on Silicon, how many times are you sort of engaged? Was it a daily thing or?
Well, the first day, yeah, it was crazy. I went on for a good like three hours or so. Remember just taking forever and stuff like that. And then it went quiet and you have to like quiet patches and then something will kick off again and stuff. And then the op was to be to build some patrol bases for the ANA so they can patrol out of. That was what the whole op was gonna be. Obviously we had to clear these objectives around the op for the location of the patrol bases. So lots of different compounds had to be checked and stuff. And that sort of thing when a massive firefight happened, and then after that died down, we just went on to with the mission, like building their patrol bases and stuff.
Would you still come into contact during that period?
That was quite often from then on, like about a week later, over a week and a half later. I remember the next morning actually we come out of the vehicle and stuff, and we're heading towards like where we were going to keep like kit and sleep and stuff and control out of all the bases, like around the surrounding area. At the moment, like, it's like an A&A shot house. I think they don't understand. Well, we all thought it was Taliban. And the guys are like, digging in with their ideas and fucking... It was the A&A shooting at us. And massive, like, all there, you can imagine, like... And the high commanders and stuff like that, but yeah, after that it was quiet, just like intercom, like the general threat over the radio, that was it.
And how were you moving about? Were you in, I take it you were in vehicles at that stage, really?
In vehicles, we got to like the bases where we were going to get, like, where we were going to patrol from and stuff and stag from and stuff, just like when they're dealing with the bases, like they've got a surrounding area, like. My B company, like, I was with 7 platoon, like, you have 5 platoon in another base, just to give them all-round protection and stuff like that, and then just going out by foot, and then sometimes out by vehicle and stuff like that.
What size of patrols were you going out on?
Sections sometimes, or sometimes just how strong force it would be between, like, between charge.
And are you carrying any sort of different, I mean, because obviously you talked about patrolling in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
How does that differ when you were doing it in Afghanistan?
The kits usually break down as well. And I had all my kit. Obviously you had, the FSG were like in cut down Land Rovers. So you had them with like 50 cal, like, in our patrol as well, and stuff. But we've got constant protection all the way around.
How long were you doing the operation for?
It took about a week, just over a week and a half, maybe something like that. Just to build them bases, then for 3 patrol bases. And then it was back to Bastion.
What was the time then between obviously with Bastion and going out again? What was it? Did you have a period of time off?
Yeah, a few weeks, and then I was then out to sailing. Bob Robinson went there, and then we went insane, and we'd actually got told it was going to be a 4-day op we were going out for, but we were out there for a month. Bob Robinson, and then we split up, and then we'd do a stint insane and stuff like that.
What was, can you describe to me, like, you know, Bob Robinson, what it's like?
It's just like a massive duff ball, that's what it was. It's a massive place that had, like, Americans, Canadians, obviously sangers all built around it and stuff like that. Got a massive open area and stuff. Had artillery in there, engineers, logistics courts and everything. This is like a base, but probably where they're going to stay for the whole 6 months. Yeah, really advanced. It's all built up and stuff, and like there's ongoing building progress and that and stuff as well. But yeah, just like a massive, like, camp sort of thing.
And you were, what were you going out from there?
Yeah, we went out and went to Sain, like just down the road to the Sain District Centre. We went up down to there. We went to Sain, we didn't do patrols out of there as well. We didn't patrol out of Fog Robinson, which coming from vehicles to Sain District Centre, and then we'll do patrols around the Sain area.